What happens now after efforts fell apart to restore unemployment benefits?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. President Obama is due in North Carolina today to talk about manufacturing jobs. His speech comes just a day after negotiations in the Senate broke down that might have restored benefits for people recently cut off from long-term unemployment payments. Dan Bobkoff reports on what could be next for 3.8 million Americans who still can't find work after 6 months.
Russ Lane of Durham left his newspaper job 6 years ago to take care of a sick family member. He hasn't had steady work since and says no matter what companies think of his resume.
If the paper doesn't look exactly as, you know, they so choose, then, you know, they'll make the decision.
William Dickens of Northeastern University says if you're qualified and recently unemployed, you have about a 10 to 20% chance of landing an interview for a job.
Compared to after 6 months, you had somewhere in the range of a 1 to 2% chance of being called in for a job.
Dickens commends the president for calling on companies to stop rejecting these workers outright. Michael Strain of the American Enterprise Institute has his own ideas, like the government helping the long-term unemployed move to where there are more jobs.
It may make sense to say, hey, we'll cut you a check and help you move to, you know, say, North Dakota, where there are a lot of jobs.
Strain also thinks a lower minimum wage might entice companies to take a chance on these workers, though he doesn't expect the president to take him up on that idea. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Today in San Diego, the NCAA kicks off its annual convention. To be discussed, should schools pay student-athletes? Several college football players have been wearing patches with the letters APU on them, All Players United. They say they deserve a share of the profits generated by their performance. NCAA President Mark Emmert supports the idea of letting schools pay athletes modest stipends. Marketplace's David Weinberg has more.
There are two questions at the heart of this issue, says Lake Forest economics professor Robert Boddy. One is, can schools afford to pay players? And the second is, should they pay players?
And if we're considering it from a purely economic point of view, is, of course, if they create value, they should be compensated, as we do in any business.
Boddy believes there's no question that teams can afford to pay players. Profits from TV contracts, bowl games, and endorsements generate tens of millions of dollars for college football programs. If the NCAA decides to allow schools to pay players, that money will have to come out of someone's pocket. One likely target, says sports economist Alan Sanderson, is the coaches.
Not all, but close to all of this, of the states in the United States, the highest paid public official is a football coach at the flagship state university.
In the current system, coaches play a crucial role in luring players to teams. Sanderson says that role would be diminished if teams could use money to lure athletes. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Want to see Marketplace live? You can enter to win a chance to join us at the Norse Theater in San Francisco on January 28th as we discuss the new era of philanthropy. Details and rules at marketplace.org/trip. The central bank in Switzerland has a bunch of gold in its treasure chest, but you know what's been happening to gold over the last year. The price plummeted, putting the squeeze on to the point that the Swiss National Bank can't pay a dividend to shareholders. At America's central bank, the Federal Reserve, the issue is less gold and more all the bonds it's been buying. Those are not collapsing, but what about the longer-term trend? Let's talk about that with Alan Sloan, senior editor-at-large at Fortune Magazine. Morning, Alan.
Good morning, David.
Well, just remind us, right? This is not the moment to have a big pile of bonds sitting there.
Right. Last year, if you owned bonds, you cried a lot because the price of long-term bonds went down because interest rates went up. And the last thing you would want to have now is $4 trillion worth of bonds, which is what the Federal Reserve has.
They've been buying lots of bonds, of course, to stimulate the economy. So now it has this big balance sheet full of these things. They're not going upward, it doesn't seem. Is this Armageddon?
No.
No, but that means the Fed's not going to make as much of a profit as it's been making.
Well, that's true, but the Fed is still going to be okay. And because of an accounting change the Fed made 3 years ago, they don't even have to show on their balance sheet that the price of the bonds in their portfolio has dropped, as opposed to the Swiss National Bank, which had to show that the value of its gold had tanked.
So as the bond portfolio decreases, the Fed, you argue, would also lose political capital.
Right. When interest rates go down and some other technical stuff happens, the amount of money the Fed sends to Washington is inevitably going to decline. And Washington being what it is, the ruling ethos is, what have you done for me lately? And they're just going to send less money in the future than they've been sending the past few years.
And this empowers the people who don't like the Fed, those who think it's too powerful, those who think it plays too activist a role in the economy. Because if it's not a cash cow, maybe it's a sitting duck.
Oh, that's a terrible pun. Yeah. And again, I am not a worshiper of the Fed, but the Fed at least functions. It means well. It's reputable. It tries to be honest. And the last thing we need are those geniuses from Congress administering policies of the Fed and calling people in and auditing them. So my concern is when the Fed starts sending less money to Washington, it's going to hurt the Fed's political standing. And I think that would be a bad thing. But financially, sending less money doesn't matter.
All right. Alan Sloan, senior editor-at-large at Fortune. Thank you.
My pleasure, David.
And when you print up business cards, you want to put your best foot forward. Take Chen Guangbiao, the CEO of a recycling company in Nanjing, China. According to his business card, he's quite a guy. China's foremost environmental preservation demolition expert, it says in English. It also lists him as most influential person of China, plus most prominent philanthropist of China, and, quote, most well-known and beloved Chinese role model. His business card's gone viral, and he certainly seems like a good man to have in your contacts list. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.